series. This is part two in a study that we're doing in 1 Peter called Fuel for Your Faith. And, you know, one of the things that I read this last week is that 74% of Americans, they asked them in the last month, as a result of the uncertainty about the economy, you know, how many people are nervous about things. And 74% of the people responded that they were, that it had had some sort of effect on their life, lost sleep, extra stress on their relationships. And I was thinking about how, you know, there are so many different things in life that distract us from the things that are important to focus on. You know, and whether it's the economy or your health, fear about the future, maybe it's your toys that you have. You know, there's so many different things. We're pulled in so many different directions. I think it's easy to be distracted from the things that really are supposed to be the most important things that occupy our focus of our lives. 1 Peter was written in large part to help people who could have very easily been distracted because of the fear of persecution because of their faith in Jesus. I want to read you a quote from a Roman historian. The book of 1 Peter was written about 64 AD. And so I want you to think, you know, whatever distracts you from being wholeheartedly committed to God, whether it's other people giving you a hard time, whether, you know, whatever it is that distracts you from being focused on the kind of life that God wants you to live, I want you to listen to what the people that Peter was writing to, what did they have to deal with? There's a Roman historian that wrote, he was, at the time of Peter, when Peter wrote this, he was about 12 years old, but he wrote not long afterwards about what life was like for Christians. And he was not a Christian himself, but he talks a little bit about it. This is what he says. Besides being put to death, Christians were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were covered with wild beast skins, torn to death by dogs. Some were crucified, others set on fire to serve to illuminate the night when daylight faded. Fastened on crosses, and when the daylight failed, covered by inflammable matter, that way they would burn longer, were set on fire to serve as torches during the night. Or tied to stakes in Nero's garden while he drove around in his chariots, naked, indulging himself in midnight revels, gloating over the dying agonies of his victims. The Roman Christians, accused by Nero of setting fire to the city, were massacred in a spectacular fashion on Vatican Hill. You think of whatever you have in your life that distracts you from being focused on being the kind of person that God wants you to be. Can you imagine what it would have been like for these people? Unimaginable fear, and that kind of fear living under that kind of uncertainty. If I may have to die a painful death. If I die, who's going to provide, take care of my family? They didn't have social services like we have now. Do you think that it's possible that this kind of fear that these people were living under could have distracted them from living the kind of life that God wanted them to live? Absolutely. That's the very reason why Peter wrote this book, was to Christians enduring unbelievable persecution. Dan titled his message last week, Three Things to Remember When You're Discouraged. You know, when we think about the kind of discouragement we go through versus the kind of discouragement or fear of the future that these guys might have lived in, whoa! But whether you were, see, here's the beauty of the book of 1 Peter. Whether you were a Christian living in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago, facing an uncertain future, or whether you're a Christian today living in South Lake Tahoe, being pushed and pulled in a million directions by all these different commitments that weigh on you, fear about the future, about your job, tension in your family, whatever it is, these people had a lot that could have easily distracted them from their faith, trusting and following God's path for their life. The same thing is true for us, isn't it? And Peter writes some very simple, very practical things to help you stay focused on living the way God desires for us to live. There's a picture of my son Levi, and this was his 8th birthday. And so I've got a kind of a series of things that I do with my kids as they grow up, a series of these kinds of events that I do with them, each one of them a little bit different, all to help them to focus on certain different life lessons. So when they're 8 years old, I take my boys, just them, on a flight somewhere and spend a couple of days out away from our everyday life. And when they're 8 years old, what I talk about is two important priorities that I want them to make central to their values in life. The first one is what does it mean to be a participant in the Largent family? In other words, not just a kid that grows up taking advantage of the resources that mom and dad provide, but what does it look like for them as they grow up to participate in what happens as our family, to use their gifts, their time, their energy to help make our family better, stronger, or a happier place to be? And then the other thing that we talk about on their 8-year-old trip is what does it mean to be the very best brother that you can be? Levi is the oldest of my boys, and so, you know, he in particular has kind of this extra duty or extra weight because he really does help set the tone for what his brothers growing up underneath him are going to learn and watch and see about what it means to be a participant in the family, but also to love and take care of his brothers. Why do I do these things? Well, it's because I think that in life, because our family is so busy, that if I don't take time to get away from the busyness of life and focus on some of these things, they won't become set in their minds as priorities of the things that they need to hold above kind of that fray of life, what's most important. So I set aside these times to go and do these different things. And what happens as a result of that is then throughout the year, the years to come, and even before that, it's an opportunity for Heather and I to go back and revisit. And in their minds, they can recall some of those basic principles that are most important things for them to focus on in their life. I was talking with Levi last night about our trip that we're doing to Desolation Wilderness. In a couple days, we're doing a backpack trip. And this is his 10-year-old trip. And he knows the routine already because we've done enough of these things. He goes, "So, Dad, what are we going to talk about on this trip?" I said to him, I said, "Levi, we're going to talk about the difference between being a boy and a man." And he kind of looks at me for a minute, and he's going like this with his mouth, and he goes, "Well, Dad, there is no difference. They both have wee-wees." My wife, who is on the floor across the room in the bedroom stretching, she looks at me and she goes, "Yep. And when they're little, they like to play with them. And when they get older, they still like to play with them." Honesty in advertising, right? Anyway, so, you know, my son, I want to talk to him about all of those sort of things. And these events are important because what they do is I want to set up in my son's mind what are the things that are most important that ought to captivate his attention, his time, his energy, and his focus as he's growing up? These are the most important things to focus on. See, if you can latch on to a couple of those key things in life that are most important from God's perspective, it will go a long ways in helping you not be distracted. Because we all live in a world where, again, whether it's because of your fears about the future, whether it's because of family tension, your health, you may just be overcommitted in life. It's so easy to be distracted away from living and focusing on the principles that God really wants you to focus on. And so what I want to talk about, if you've got your notes, you can pull them out here. I've got three key principles that I want you to think about that Peter lays out for us. And the first thing is Peter says, you know, I want you to remember what life is really all about. And he starts out his passage. We're working from 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13 through chapter 2, verse 2. A big section. He starts out verse 13 by saying, "Therefore, as a result of," And what Peter is going to lay out for us is, I want you to remember the things that I just wrote about, because they're the keys to life in the first 13 verses of this book. You remember what Dan said last week? He said, first of all, he says, don't ever forget the family that you've been adopted into. One of the key things that will help you stay focused is if you never forget your identity, that you have been bought and chosen and adopted to be part of this royal family where God is the Father and the head. And we can go to Him anytime about anything. And we get all the rights and privileges both now and forever as a result of being adopted into this incredible family. That's the first thing Dan reminded us of. The second thing that he reminded us of is, don't ever forget that the hard times that you go through in life, the challenges, God uses all of those things to help make you more like His Son, Jesus. That's God's purpose in allowing you to go through the trials and the hard times that you go through. It all serves this great purpose of helping make you more like His Son in your character. And then the third thing he says is, don't ever forget how special this salvation, this rescuing thing that God has done for us by bringing us out of a place where we were separated from Him to being in a place where we are now adopted as His child. Don't ever forget how special that really is and all that it took for God to bring that to pass. It wasn't because of how good or smart or all the good things that you did. God did that as a work Himself. You remember what Dan said last week as we read through those passages about how, you know, this thing that God is doing, it has been a mystery throughout history. And remember, even in the Old Testament, Dan brought up that the prophets, they didn't even fully understand this miraculous and amazing thing that God was doing. And they were moved as they were writing about it. And they got glimpses of what God was doing. It's just like what Paul says. Paul comments on the same thing. You know what Paul says? Paul says, this salvation, which the angels long to look into. In other words, God is saying that even the angels themselves are watching history and watching what God is doing. And that word long to look into, you know what that word means in Greek? It means that they were fixated. They're fixated on what God was doing. Wow. Can you believe this amazing thing that God is working out in the world? Don't ever forget how amazing it is, the work that God is doing in your life. I've commented on this a number of times, but you know, when I grew up, I didn't grow up in a family where I went to church or had any really interest in God at all. And you know, I need to be reminded of this regularly, how the way I was living and the choices I was making as I was growing up, if I had continued on that path, I don't know where I would have ended up, but there's a good chance that I'd be looking through bars whoever I was talking to right now. I was not on a good career or life path because of the result of the choices I was making. And the nature of my character that was dictating those choices, it's pretty sad to look back and think of why I was living the way I was, how self-centered, how selfish I was making the choices I was. Not that I'm perfect now, but man, I genuinely can look today at the person that I am today, and I can see the work, and it hasn't been easy, but the work that God has been doing, the work of salvation, of saving. He saved me, not only from a life of pain and dead end, but from an eternity. And it's all as a result of this work that God's been doing in my life. And Peter says, don't ever forget this beautiful, amazing work that God is doing in your life. Stay focused on those three things. And if you do, that goes a long ways towards helping you remember what's most important in life so that you won't be distracted. It's interesting, as a result of all of this stuff, though, he says, There are some things you need to do because it's not all just information in your head. But this information ought to change. It ought to impact the very choices you make in life. Because our faith, our trust in God, plays itself out every day in the decisions that we make, doesn't it? So he says in verse 13, he says, as a result of knowing that this is what life is all about, here's some things that you need to be ready to do. The first one is you need to prepare your minds for action. And he draws on this Old Testament term of, this is the guys, they're getting ready to go into battle, and they would take their tunics, and it's girding up your loins. They'd take their tunics, wrap them up, stuff them in their belt, because they needed to be ready to run, fight, and get down to business, right? And you didn't want that stuff encumbering you when you were fighting. It was get ready, because this is going to require some action on your part. And that's what Peter says. As a result of focusing on what's most important in life, it's going to cause you to change some of the decisions and basic principles that you live your life by. He says it's also important to stay sober. In your Bible, it may say, be self-controlled. But, you know, honestly, the better translation for this, and if you have a King James Bible, it's be sober. And we don't ever talk about like this anymore. But you know what that means? It means be clear in your head about what your purpose is all about. Because if your mind is full of all sorts of things and you're not clear-minded, it's going to be difficult for you to take the action steps that God desires for you to work out in your life. Be clear-minded. This becomes one of Peter's favorite illustrations about being clear in your head about the principles that you live your life by. He uses it in chapter 4, verse 7. He says, be clear in your mind so that you can pray. That tells us, I think, one of our basic priorities in life. How many of you have ever been like I am all the time, where I'm having a conversation with someone, and in the midst of the conversation, I've got this track running in the back of my head that's saying, you know, don't spend too long in this conversation because you've got X, Y, and Z to get done. You know, and I'm having trouble really being focused on just that conversation, just being tuned in with that person at that moment. And very oftentimes in the course of those conversations, someone's talking about life and a personal struggle or some difficulty that they're going through in their life. And in my mind, I go, you know what? I'll keep you in prayer. How many of you have ever said that before? I'll keep you in prayer. Only two of you. That's interesting. The rest of you are either asleep or never say that. And here's a bigger question. How many of you ever said, I'll keep that in prayer, and then didn't pray for that person, right? An awful lot of us. That happens all the time. And see, part of what Peter says is, what could be more important than praying? What could be more important than being engaged with someone who's talking about life and not stopping whatever you're doing and recognizing the most important thing you could do right then is take that person before the throne of God and talk to him about whatever is going on in their life? But because we are pulled, because we're distracted, we don't make time for the things that genuinely are the most important things that ought to occupy our time and our focus and our relationships with other people. I'm kind of sick this morning. It's really weird. I got a fever. I've had it for the last 2 days, and I feel, you know, achy. But my stomach is fine, and I'm not congested. It's really weird. I haven't felt like this in my life. It's kind of bizarre. And so it started on Friday night, and I was on the phone with Chris Brackett, and he's talking to me. He says, you know, well, what are you doing? What's going on? I said, oh, I'm just trying to finish up my message, and I'm not feeling that good. And as I'm saying that, as the words are coming out of my mouth, Chris sort of interrupts me and starts praying for me right then and there on the phone. And I thought, you know, I was so blessed afterwards that he wouldn't just take what I said and said, oh, man, I hope you get better or I'll pray for you later. But that he took time right then and there. I think that that's part of the basic principle of how we ought to live our life is that we're engaged in people's life. And in the midst of being engaged in their life, we've always got them and been willing to take them before God or take whatever issues or concerns or things that we have right then and there. Because what better thing could you do? And what better privilege as a result of being part of the family of God could you ever exercise than to make prayer a basic priority? And what is he saying? He said, the only way you live like that is if you are clear in your thinking, sober in your judgment. It's the only way that happens. The other thing he says is in chapter 5, verse 8, he says, keep your mind clear, be sober-minded and alert, because your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a lion, waiting for someone to devour. Peter, he says, this is serious stuff. Do you recognize that you've got an adversary who's out there, who's looking for any opportunity where you'll be asleep at the wheel, and he will pounce on you like that? That's part of the reality of the world we live in. There's not just good and no evil. There's not just God and no devil, right? There is this reality that we live in a world where there's these two very real, very opposing forces that are at war with one another. And we're caught in the middle of that. And Satan and his demons will do anything they can. It sounds so passe. People go, you don't really believe that stuff, do you? I go, well, I believe there's a God. I believe that there's Jesus. And I believe what he said was true. And he talks about this stuff. And I don't just believe there's a God and there's good. I believe that there's a cause and a purpose and a reality for the evil that we see in the world. And those two things are at war with one another. And we genuinely are caught in the middle of those things. And if we align ourselves with God, he will make himself available for us to be used for his good purposes. And if not, or you fall asleep at the wheel, you better believe that Satan is ready and willing to pounce and take advantage of any opportunity he can. If you're not clear-minded and you're not self-controlled, he will take advantage of those opportunities. The third thing he says is, you know what, as a result of all this stuff, and you know the keys to life, live a life full of hope. Even though you don't know what's happening in the future, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And think about Peter writing to people that as Christians, the next day could be their last day. They could be that torch. He says, live your life full of hope, because you know that whatever may come, you're in the hands of God, and he's got your ultimate future secure. So you can face whatever may come with full confidence that you've got God on your team. And in the end, he will use you in whatever way he wants for glory for his purposes. And in the end, you and I will live with him in eternity, serving him, living in the relationship that he always desired and designed for us to live in. I was watching this mountain bike race yesterday and online. It's called the Leadville 100, and it's in Leadville, Colorado. And people say it's the most brutal mountain bike race in the world. And it takes place almost entirely above 10,000 feet, all 100 miles of it. The guy who won yesterday, so first time he's ever raced in it, but he's raced in the Tour de France, I think, 14 different times. He's been a podium finisher in the Tour de France. So racing in hard races is not a new thing to him. He's been a professional bike racer his whole life. And he said in the interview I was watching afterwards, he said, this was one of the hardest days I've ever spent on my bike. He said, the last 25 miles, all I could do to get through was focus on the next 100 yards, the next 200 yards, the tree up there, crossing that stream, making it around that corner. It's the only way he could coax himself into making it to the end. And this wasn't a guy who just survived the race. This is the guy who won the race. And you wonder, well, why would you put yourself through all of that? Because he knew that the finish line, that the reward was worth whatever he had to go through to get there. And in fact, I think one of the realities is when we know that reward is that valuable, it even sort of makes there's some enjoyment, I think, even in some of the hardship of making it to that end, isn't it? It's one of the things that helps us make those end rewards so valuable, is that we know whatever we have to go through, and it's not going to be easy, it's really worth it. See, that's one of the things that if you can keep in your mind, Peter says that you can live with hope, even though it's uncertain, even though it may be scary, even though you may go through hard times, because you know that that end result is worth whatever it takes to make it. And that's that hope is that very real, certain future that you know is waiting for you out there, which allows you to live like that. The second key focus in here is he says, you know what? As a result of this, you need to focus on living a life of holiness. And the word holiness is a word that's thrown around a lot, and I want to talk just a little bit about it, because really it's got a very simple definition. What it means is holiness means that you take a common article, something that is common, that doesn't have intrinsic value in and of itself, but you take that thing and you set it apart and you use it for some special, significant purpose. And Peter says, you know what? That's what your life is all about. That God took you. You are common. You're not all that different than anybody else. Your life is there's not something supernatural or something amazing about you in and of who you are. But you know what? God takes you, a common person, a common individual, man or woman, and he sets you aside to be used for some very special, very specific purpose. And what's that purpose all about? Well, think back to the Old Testament and think back to the nation of Israel. I want you to think about how God called the people, the Jews. He says, you are a holy nation. You are to be a set apart people. So God took this group of people and he took them out of all the other nations, people groups of the world, and he set them apart and he says, you alone are going to represent to the rest of the world what it looks like to have a different set of priorities to live your life by. And as you live in relationship with me, you will demonstrate to the rest of the world how I want people to live. You know, in that time, when Abraham was living, where God called those people apart, part of what was going on is there was like just one simple way to understand this is people worship the created things. People worship the sun. They worship the rain. They worship mountains. They worship all these different created things. And part of what God calls the nation of Israel to do was don't focus on the created things, but worship the Creator who made, who formed, who sustains, who holds all that stuff together. You are going to be different. You're going to have a deeper understanding of all of this stuff than everyone else around you. And part of that understanding is going to transform the choices and the priorities and principles which govern your way of life. And in doing that, you will help other people understand what it looks like to live the kind of life that I designed you to live. Do you understand that illustration of Israel is no different than what God has called each one of you to do? God's called you that even though you live in this world that worships houses, boats, trees, mountains, the sky, the environment, God's called you out of that culture and says, I want you to show other people what it looks like when you organize your life around worshiping not the created things, but worshiping the Creator. And it will change the way you live your life. It'll change the way you think about money. It'll change the way you think about your time. Right? I mean, like, here's a simple illustration of how having God at the center of your life ought to impact the way you organize your time. How many of you watch that video and you think, oh man, it'd be great for me. I'd love to spend an hour a week. But then when you really get down to the brass tacks, you go, well, I got this going on, and this, blah, blah, and you start listing off all the different things that you're involved with, all the different things that take up your time, and you go, whoa, you know what? I'd love to be a part of something like that, but I don't have time. You find that you are so stretched, so overcommitted, that you can't be invested in something like that. See, I genuinely believe that if God is at the center of your principles and priorities, you start to think about how you are investing your time. And are you doing just what everybody else is doing? Are you so overcommitted because that's how everybody else lives? Or are you thinking, you know what, my time is precious, it belongs to God, God wants me to be involved in simple things that make a difference in the lives of other people in the community I live in. So you know what, I need to learn to say No. You know, if you're like me, it's a hard word to say. No. To a lot of other things that other people would say yes to, so that I can make time and make it a priority to be able to spend time doing some things like that. And the only way you do that is if you come to a place where you recognize my time, all of it, it belongs to God, and I need to think about how am I really investing my days in a way that brings Him honor, brings Him glory, that makes a difference, a substantial difference in the world and in the lives of the other people where I live. That's what it means to be holy. And he draws us out by saying, you know what, there was a way before you knew God. There was a conformity, like I was talking about in my own life. My life was driven by selfishness. My life was all about me and pleasing Noah. And he says, you know, before you knew God, you were driven by whatever your priorities and principles were. But don't be conformed to that mold anymore. There's a whole new set of things that ought to conform your time. And those things are the things, those are the principles and priorities that God has for your life. Why is that so important? Because if you are called to be set apart, one of the things that God will do is you recognize you will have to stand before Him. We all will. And you'll have to give an account for how you used your time, money, energy, and gifts and resources. And you will be called to give an account whether you use those things in a way that genuinely honored God. And holiness also reminds us that the whole way that I became set apart was not because I was redeemed. If you read in there, it says, you weren't bought with gold or silver. That's Peter's way of saying, you know what? You weren't ransomed from that old way of living where you were separated from God by a bunch of money. You weren't bought with that kind of stuff. You were bought with something far more precious, right? You were bought with what? The blood of the Son of God Himself. You were bought with Jesus' blood. That's how you became holy. That's how you became set apart. As a result of that, man, all of this stuff takes on a whole new meaning, a whole new set of how important this stuff is to keep at the forefront of my life. And as a result of all this, it changes some of my basic priorities. And the first one, Peter says, is it changes you to be a person who focuses on yourself to being a person who focuses on other people. You have a whole new love for the group of people that you live around. He does this kind of cool thing here with the Greek. Because if you read in there, in what verse is it? It's in verse 22. He does this kind of cool thing. He says you've got this new kind of brotherly love. When he says that, he says, you know, in your Bibles, it just says you love other people and then you love them sincerely from the heart. And it just says love and love. No difference between the two things. But he uses these two different Greek words to talk about love. The first one is phileo, which is where, you know, it's where we get our word Philadelphia from. And Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love, right? And so I was thinking about how, you know, like how well this is illustrated by someone who comes from Philadelphia, Pat Baginski. And so Pat and I get together once a week in the morning with some other guys. And one of the things over the years that I've recognized about Pat is Pat kind of talks about being from Philadelphia with this kind of this fondness, this affection that he has for the place and the people and the culture. And it's a genuine kind of felt affection. I think that that's not a big stretch. I mean, most of you would say, you know, I experience that kind of love on a regular basis from my wife, my kids, my neighbors. I sympathize with people in my town when they're going through a hard time. You've got this kind of affection for the place where you live and the people that you're surrounded by. But here's what he does. He doesn't just leave it at that place of this relational affection. The next word he uses is the word agape. And that's an athletic term that describes love. That says it's not enough to just have a heart for other people, to have sort of an affection for them. The real kind of love that comes from living a holy life is a kind of love that is a love that you strive for, that takes effort. It's not easy. It's the kind of love that doesn't give because of what it will get back. think about this. Think about how you, very oftentimes we're willing to do something, some sort of act of self-sacrifice for someone else. But generally, we do those kinds of acts of self-sacrifice with people that we feel like, if I do this for you, I know that somewhere down the line, you'll give back to me in that same kind of way. Because that's the kind of relationship we have. But you see, that's not what he's talking about here. He's saying, you give not ever because of what you get back. You give because you are invested in the other person's best, in helping them become all that they can be, in giving to them whatever they can use that will help them be successful or get through whatever challenges in life. Not because there's ever anything in it for you. You know, and it would be totally ironic if we talked about that and didn't recognize who said that. Remember Peter? Remember that Peter is the guy that he was a fisherman and he went fishing. He went fishing until Jesus says, hey, come and follow me. But do you notice that Peter goes back to fishing and Jesus has to go and get him back, calls him back again? And when things are going well and Peter's in the limelight traveling with Jesus, it's all good, right? But remember the night when Jesus was betrayed, this guy that had stuck himself out and provided and taken care of Jesus all along the way for 3.5 years, when it gets really hard and it really hits the fan, Peter does what? I never knew him. Not once, not twice, but 3 times Peter denied Jesus. He didn't just have that affection, but he even abandoned that kind of striving, committed love for Jesus. He was out of there, man. But Peter recalled the words of Jesus, where Jesus, in that upper room, he says to his friends when he's about to leave, he says, a new commandment I give you. This is John chapter 13, 34 and 35. A new commandment I give to you. You must love one another as I have loved you. Right? And that word love right there that Jesus uses with his friends is that word agape. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. Jesus says, as I have given unselfishly to you, that's how you're supposed to love other people. Did Jesus love the disciples? Did he die on the cross because of what they were going to give him? No. Because if he did, he would have wasted our time because they weren't always faithful. They didn't always follow through. But Jesus taught them, showed them what that committed kind of love is all about. See, that's why you have been set apart. So you can demonstrate to the rest of the world the kind of love that God has for you. See, he modeled it for us. He says that's how you ought to be invested in the lives of other people. Is it going to be easy? No. Was Jesus hurt when Peter denied him and walked away from him? Absolutely. But that didn't stop him from following through with that committed love that he had for his friends. So he didn't do it because of what he could get back. And that's the reason we've been set apart, is so that we can live out that kind of commitment. And remember I said, why do we do that? Because it's the same reason Israel was supposed to do that. When Israel demonstrated to the rest of the world, it was supposed to cause this curiosity in the rest of the nations. Wow, these guys got something that is so different from the way everybody else is living. They are not like everybody else. They've got something unique and kind of cool going on. And see, I'm convinced that when you and I take that kind of love, because we've been set apart seriously, we're not conformed to the old way of living, that God uses that to cause a curiosity in your friends, the people you work out with, the places where you work, even in your own family. God causes that to stir up this kind of curiosity and hunger. What is it that makes you have that kind of love for other people? And at some point you may get to tell them, you know what, I learned it from someone. You could tell them about how you learned it from the example that Jesus set. See, Jesus says, a new commandment I give you, love one another as I have loved you. And then the very next verse says, all men will know you're my disciples if you... Oh, there's one person in here who knows that verse. If you... Okay, I'll give you a hint. It's love one another. One last time. If you... If you love one another, all men will know that you're holy, that you've been set apart by God for His purposes. And it will cause a hunger to stir up in other people. Last thing I want to talk about. Key number three. I hate this word born again because I don't like the way our culture uses it. I mean, brother, you've been born again. You've got to be born again. And people don't have any idea what that means. But it's, you know what? It's a thoroughly biblical word. Peter uses it here. Jesus, when he's talking to Nicodemus, talks about the importance of being born again, of having a new life. And in his, one of the things he says is he uses this kind of funny language. He says, you've been born again of an, not of a perishable, but an imperishable seed. This is so weird that he would talk about a seed that is imperishable. But I want to talk about why I think this is such a cool illustration and all these neat things that we can get out of it. You know, if you hold a seed in your hand, in and of itself, it's not all that impressive, is it? But you know that in that seed there is all this amazing potential for life, right? I mean, a seed is, it's an amazing thing. It's incredible. In order for that seed to grow, though, it's got to be planted in something, in some kind of soil. And so I was talking with a farmer, and he was explaining to me, you know, if you really want to create an environment where a seed, all of that potential can come out, you don't just go out and beat the soil, you know. He says you go out and you break it up, and he says that breaking up, you know, that plowing can, you know, that can be a big process, taking something and wedging it, tilling, pulling it apart. But he says that's not all you do. If you really want to get the best results after you originally break it up, it's important to give it a good amount of moisture. And what you do is when you give it that moisture, you want to go back out and you want to till it or break it up some more. That moisture will allow you to even get a better mix of the soil and the nutrients that are in it. And he says if you really, really want to make an ideal environment for that seed to grow, then what you'll do is you'll wet it again, and this time you'll take out and you'll spread fertilizer in it. And you will go back through and you will break it up, roll it over, mix it up some more. He says, then you've got a much more ideal environment for growth when you put that seed to take place. I was thinking, you know, have you ever thought about how part of what's led to some of the most growing experiences in your own life are the times when you've been tilled, rolled over, mixed up, broken up? You ever thought about that? In fact, one of the things I think is interesting about that is very oftentimes when I look around as a pastor at other people, the people who have experienced the most tilling very oftentimes are the people that produce the richest kind of growth in their own life. The other thing I was thinking about is you take that seed and you put it in the ground. Does it immediately sprout and flourish? Sometimes it takes a while, doesn't it, for like that potential life to actually grow out of that seed. And even after it's grown, sometimes that initial growth with the roots and stuff, a lot of that takes place under the soil where it's funny because nobody ever like really sees that, right? How many of you have ever known someone that come to church or you told them all about God and, you know, they say, I can't figure this stuff out, and you get impatient with them? Do you ever wonder if, well, I wonder if God's just growing them under the surface and it's going to take a while before I ever really see some of that stuff? Or do you ever, have you ever been through seasons in your own life where you look back and you think, wow, it took a long time. I heard a lot. I read a lot. I talked a lot with other people about God, but it took a long time for that growth to actually produce anything visible. See, and why I think that's so key is think about how hard we can be on other people when we don't see growth. And take it to that next level where you can take a plant, two seeds, put them in the ground, same water, nourishment, sunlight, all that stuff. They grow at different speeds. And think about how we treat other people. We have all these expectations about where people should be and what they should learn. Why can't they get their act straight? Did you ever think that you're not you're not the farmer, that God is, and that he's growing people, and you may not even see all the growth that's going on. And in fact, even though we're growing, sometimes fall comes around and we lose all our leaves. Like you take an aspen tree and you go in the springtime or the summer, and it's green and beautiful. You come back 3 months later and the leaves are all gone, and the thing that looks so vibrant and alive now looks dead. How many of you have ever felt like that in your own life or gone through that? I love this illustration of a seed. The other thing I hope that it causes you to do is you may run into someone and fall. You may run into someone just after they've been pruned by the gardener. Go easy on those people, because you're not the farmer. And whatever your expectations of that person may not be God's expectations. So we got to be incredibly gracious with people. And you may look back on your life and you may think, well, the very first time I heard about Jesus, man, I gave my life over to him. And you know, there may be other people that need to hear 63 times before they finally get it and decide to be planted, to give themselves over to God, right? But see, the thing about a seed is this, though. At some point, either it grows or it doesn't. It's like my wife likes to say about pregnancy. Either you are or you're not. You're not sort of pregnant, are you? You know, that, and that's really true of this picture of a seed, too, that either you have this new birth that's been planted by this imperishable seed that will grow and continue to grow and never die. That's why it's different than a regular seed. And either you have that new life or you don't. And so for some of you, you may think, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. I've been planted with that imperishable seed, but I think it's good to like go back and examine your life. If you don't see any growth and never have, you might ask yourself, was I ever really planted? Did I ever receive that new birth? Was I ever really born again? I think it's important to ask yourself that question. My last point I'd love to talk with you about, but you know what? You've got more than enough information to go home with today to think about. To remember how easy it is to be distracted by life, pulled away from being focused on what is most important to God. And the book of 1 Peter was written to help bring you back to that place where you can keep in focus those key things that will help you live the kind of life that God desires for you to live. God, thanks for the opportunity we have to get together. And Lord, I pray that even just this week, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen tonight or the rest of the day, Lord. But help us to be self-controlled, clear-minded, so that we can focus on the key things that you want for us today. God, help us to have an unyielding commitment to not just have an affectionate love for other people, but to be like seriously invested in that kind of self-sacrificial love for other people that you demonstrated for us. God, thanks for loving us. Thanks for giving us encouragement in hard and dark days. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. If our ushers will come forward, we'll continue our worship with our offering. Thanks for coming. Remember, each week when we take our offering, some of the money that we collect goes to supporting people like Frank and Rebecca and the work that they're doing in Mexico and our other missionaries that work so hard around the world for you. Thanks for coming, guys. Have a great week. God bless you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and worship again after the basket goes by. Please stand with us. And here we go. It's called We Will Stand. It's sort of, I guess, continuing the theme that we kind of started with, who our God is and what he means to us. We need you to shout on the echo parts. Get into it.